Good afternoon. I'm going to open the committee, Senate Committee on General Government Accountability for Wednesday, March 22nd, 2017. And we're going to start with 467, Senate Bill 467.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 467 authorizes the legislature in the city of Salem to agree to transfer control over city parking spaces in the Capitol Mall area to the legislature when it is in session. Provides for the legislature's discretion to prescribe or lift all manner of parking restrictions for enforcement by state police and for accounting functions to be assumed by the Department of Administrative Services. Also provides for reimbursement of costs to the city of Salem to maintain the spaces.
Thank you. I'm going to call Peggy Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for hearing this bill. For the record, my name is Peggy Boquist, and I'm from Dallas, Oregon. A fellow constituent and I came up with this idea. We call it the Capitol Mall Parking Bill, because we felt that our people that come to this building 6 months out of every other year have difficulty with parking and the parking meters, and it causes a lot of stress. And I don't want to say trauma, but there's a little bit of that, especially in our older population, which I'm becoming one of those people myself. The parking meters here have changed, but they're still difficult for some to operate. But the underlying factor here is not just the parking meters and the method of utilizing them. It's also that they limit in some degree access of our folks to assess us during our 6 months of session every other year. And so we designed this bill with the idea that it would be during the long session, what I'll refer to as the long session, that our constituents could come and go without undue stress over feeding a meter. And feeding the meter used to be done with quarters, and I personally kept a drawer full of quarters in my office for the occasional person who was panicked and would text me and say, can you feed my meter? It's on the south side or the north side or wherever it was. Run down there and find their car and feed the meter. Because they might be in a hearing, and the hearing may be a two-hour hearing, but sometimes, as you know, later in the session, the hearings go long. And they didn't want to miss their spot in the queue in order to go feed their meter. And so there was that stress. And today's meters, you can actually use a debit card. It's much more convenient, but it is difficult to negotiate the machine if you're not familiar with it. Even I had difficulty the first time. Had to read it out loud to myself. But it can be done. And I opt to pay the whole $15, the 10 hours, just because it's easier for me. But not everybody does that. If you do 2 hours or 3 hours, it's 15-minute increments, and you have to go back out there because you're here longer than you expected to be, you have to actually pay. I'll try to explain this with some clarity. You have to pay at the point of sale. You may have 15 minutes left on your card, your ticket, in your window, but you have to pay at the point of sale. You cannot you can't extend the period from the previous purchase. You pay from the point of sale to what you believe may be the end time, 2 more hours, 3 more hours, whatever it may be. And so in many cases, you are double paying for that period of time. Also, what I have noticed in the mall parking area is there is a plethora of watchers on these meters, parking meter attendants. I don't know the exact term for their role. But we did have a constituent who actually got a ticket on her car as she was at the kiosk paying for the pass. And she did have to go to court to get that relieved. It was relieved in court, but she had to go to court because she made it known to the parking attendant or the whatever the proper terminology is for that person. and they did not pull the ticket off her car. So I would like to see 6 months during our long session, a different arrangement for the parking situation out here to accommodate our constituents and our folks here in Oregon.
Questions?
Real quick. Hey, can you tell us what conversations have happened with the city as to, I'm not sure if we're going to have someone from the city here speaking.
We do have.
Chair Riley, Senator Prasansky, I had one conversation with, I believe, one of their, I don't know if it's a city employee, but a person that assists them in these kinds of issues, and wanted to know if it was a constituent-driven bill or that, and it's really a Peggy Boquist-driven bill.
That's okay.
Okay, thank you very much. So I'm going to call Tess Milo and Sarah Long.
Chair Riley, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to speak with you today on Senate Bill 467. My name is Tess Milio. I'm with CFM, and I'm representing the City of Salem. Here with me today is Sarah Long, project manager for the City of Salem. So right now, we actually do not, the City of Salem does not have an official position on this bill. It has a vetting process that we go through at the city, and so it's still in process. The council should be taking a formal position on it next week. So, you know, we have spoken with Senator Boquist's office and understand kind of the intent of the bill and wish to work further with them to see what can be done. So we're hoping to talk further with them and other stakeholders outlined in the bill. And since the city is still going through their vetting process, we're asking respectfully that we wait to move the bill today. And I'm going to let Sarah give more information. So thank you so much.
Chair Riley, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Sarah Long, and I'm with the City of Salem. And as Tess had said, the City of Salem does not currently have an official position on Senate Bill 467, and the council will be taking a position on the bill next week. As of today, the city has not yet met with any proponents of this particular bill or with the Legislative Administrative Committee to discuss it into any detail. The City of Salem owns and manages all of the parking surrounding the Capitol Mall and state agency buildings, along with other areas throughout the city. Part of the parking management requires constant upkeep and enforcement. As you may have noticed, the City of Salem recently installed parking meters around the Capitol Mall, investing about $1.1 million into the project as of fall 2016. The city implemented these new meters to improve the ease of use for customers who are now able to use debit and credit cards to pay up for 10 hours of parking in a day. We have kept our costs for parking to $1.50 an hour, or $1.50 an hour, sorry, or $15 for the full day. This is the same price we have charged for the past several years. Enforcement of parking is also performed by city staff, who are specifically dedicated to patrolling the Capitol Mall area. The management of on-street parking system is complex. And because on-street parking is designated as public parking, it must be maintained in a way that provides equity to all user groups. It is our interpretation of Senate Bill 467 that it authorizes the Legislative Administration Committee to enter into agreements with the City of Salem to assign authority over certain parking spaces. The city is concerned about the potential for inconsistent enforcement methods, which may lead to the confusion of people who are trying to park. Additionally, because the city already has parking enforcement staff who are dedicated to the area around the Capitol Mall, there's a possibility that staffing could be impacted by any agreements that are made. As currently outlined in the bill, if an agreement is reached, the Oregon State Police would replace city staff and be responsible for enforcing parking areas surrounding the Capitol Mall. We were able to obtain some information from Senator Boquist's office yesterday that allowed a better understanding of the intent behind the bill. We understand the concern of having consistent and available parking for citizens and believe the intention of the legislation is admirable. However, because we have not yet had a sit-down conversation with the proponents, the City of Salem respectfully requests the opportunity to have further discussions before Senate Bill 467 moves forward. As the entity responsible for the management of public parking and the party subject to a potential agreement as identified in the bill, the City of Salem is asking the committee for more time in order to establish an open dialogue about the matters this bill seeks to address. We are hopeful that there are ways, perhaps even without legislation, to address these issues and concerns. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, colleagues. Mr. Chair, for the record, I am Brian Boquist, State Senator, Senate District 12. Also here in my capacity from my other committee position, which is the Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committee. And I also serve on the Homeland Security Council with Senator Brzezinski, who is there. And then I am the Senate representative on the security work group in the building here. So now I will bring you up to speed. I did learn from some of my senior colleagues that sometimes it's better to go last. And so let me outline the position where we are today. I do appreciate Tessa and Sarah outlining the city's willingness to have discussions. This bill actually came out of two areas originally. First, it came out of the issue of constituents, which I believe that all of the members of the panel before me have constituents who come from Eugene and from Hillsborough and Beaverton who get to pay the $1.50 an hour outside for their parking to come testify before a committee such as this. That is the constituent side of the issue, and that's one of the originations of the bill. However, the bill was actually written and brought forward for a second purpose because sometimes constituents you are close to and you don't necessarily say, well, that's totally a good idea. So let me outline to you the second half of the purpose of this bill. For years on years, this building has functioned as an open, transparent building where people come and to and fro constantly. Unfortunately, since 9/11, we have had to try and address security issues around the building, try to address safety issues around the building. That has been done internally by the Oregon State Police. It has been done internally by the Legislative Administration Committee. And during that process, we have worked consistently over the last decade, sometimes with good results and sometimes with less than desirable results. To the various stakeholders, including the City of Salem. And without pointing fingers back and forth, we have been in discussions with them. I think all of us are aware that we have put forward a seismic plan, a security upgrade plan, and some fairly significant reconstruction issues around this building that we are in right now. So, and I do appreciate the City of Salem talking about ensuring that we don't have inconsistent processes and people don't get confused. With that, I have handed out to you a series of pictures that I want to go over with you so that we kind of understand the situation. The first picture that you have in front of you is actually taken this morning. You notice it was not raining, so that's the good news around here. And it outlines the 10-hour sign that's outside the state capitol in which it's $1.50 an hour, $15 for 10 hours. Now, if I wanted to take purely the constituent position, I think as most of you know, most individuals don't need 10 hours to come here and testify from Eugene or from Beaverton or Hillsborough. And so, you know, in a logical process, we would have sat down with the city and done some different styles of work to come up with parking meters. And I'm not even opposed personally, and I don't think the legislature is, to the city continuing keeping their revenues, whatever the system comes about. However, it starts getting more complicated after that in this particular. If you go to the second page you have, you will see the parking garage entrance to our building. There are multiple plans out there in which we need to change that parking entrance to upgrade the security. And if you'll note there, we have a nice parking meter that makes $15 for every 10 hours, right where most all of the members and the deliveries have to come into the basement. You'll also notice in that picture that the United States Postal Service mailbox is right behind that, where cars have to pull up to that location, deposit the mail in it, and then back up into the sidewalk, and hopefully, like I have almost done personally on several occasions, not run somebody over as we're doing that. This particular issue right here and the access, there have been ongoing discussions over the last couple of years with the city of Salem, and they haven't proved to fruition. Now, to be consistent, if you go to the next page, I will point out to you the Marion County Courthouse, which is three blocks from us, and you will happen to notice that the Marion County Courthouse and the county commissioners are there. When their constituents from Salem and Woodburn come, they don't pay for parking. Let me say that again. When their constituents come to their county courthouse in the city of Salem, they don't pay for parking. It's not $1.50 an hour. It's not a meter that takes X amount of money, and if somebody else moves, you have to repark it. If you go to the next sign that's out there is the City of Salem City Hall. So when the council members are having this discussion at their meeting later this week, you'll notice that the individuals who come to testify for that public hearing will have free parking. Will have free parking for their constituents to come discuss with them. I actually just to point out some of the interesting things there. In the next sheet, you'll see two pages. One is called Scenario 3 and Scenario 4. And I don't want to depress you too much, but you're all going to see this in the very future. This is actually from the Joint Transportation Committee presentation on Monday evening. And you'll notice that the 24-cent increase there is actually a gas tax increase that's being asked for. And the next page that's over there is a 52% gas tax increase that's being asked for the gas tax. And though I'm not sure that any of us are going to vote for either of those two, that is the money that helps pay for the streets in the city of Salem and the rest of the cities that are out there. So let me clarify again why we're actually having the discussions. Our Legislative Administration Committee, under previous directors, have had discussions with the city of Salem, and we have not quite got their attention yet. It apparently we have got their attention now on trying to develop a policy in which the legislature has more oversight of the access to the building, more ability to make sure that it is a safe and secure facility, and more ability in the future when we go into our phased construction that's in this building and our security improvements that we can remove certain parking locations and ensure better access. I am happy to sit down now that we have the attention of the city of Salem and work on some of these issues. But committee members, I would point out to you some of the security upgrades that we have already approved on the floor of both chambers require the removal of some of these parking meters with or without, let me say that again, with or without the agreement of the city of Salem if we're going to protect our own employees. With that, I'd be happy to entertain questions.
Questions? I don't see any questions.
We'll wait to hear what response we get from the city, and please keep us advised.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, and I look forward to those future discussions.
Thank you. We don't have the paperwork we need to move this anyway, so we're going to just close this public hearing. What do we got next?
Senate Bills 102 and 41, Mr. Chair. Public records bills.
106. Repeats of the people. I got multiple on each one.
Probably yes. So I'm gonna open a joint public hearing on Senate Bill 106 and Senate Bill 481. Okay. Do you wanna give us a little rundown on them first?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 106 was previously heard on, February the 6th. This is the governor's bill. It has a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means. This is the governor's public records bill. The measure has a number of provisions creating a public records advocate and a public records advisory council and making policy statements. All of that was discussed by the Attorney General who was appeared in February. There are also a number of amendments pending, which folks are here to talk about today. One in particular that represents the bulk of the changes prepared by a work group at the governor's office is delayed through no fault of the stakeholders. We were hoping to have it today, but we don't. So that's characterized as a pending amendment in the staff measure summary. and it should locate the advocate in the Archives Division of the Secretary of State's office, require the council to nominate three candidates for the governor to choose one appointee. It should permit the advocate to be removed for cause by the governor or the council. It makes mediation discretionary at the local level. It should allow persons seeking records to opt out of mediation within 5 days of a state agency request. It should remove advisory opinions, separate public records exemption for the public records advocate. It excludes the judicial department. It adds two additional members of the news media, representatives of local governments, special district, and cities, and a member of the public sector workforce, also a state representative and one state senator to the council, and sunsets in 2020. The Dash 9 amendment was received from Senator Thatcher's office today. That directs the Secretary of State to appoint the advocate without Senate confirmation and to provide the office and staff support for the advocate. The Dash 10 amendment permits the advocate to prepare reports and studies in addition to those that are required by the underlying measure. The Dash 11 amendment replaces the public records advisory account with a public records advisory fund for continuous appropriations. And the Dash 12 amendment, I believe I mentioned that already as part of the amendment that's pending, one representative each from cities, counties, and special districts to the council.
Thank you. Rep. Huffman, did you want to bring anyone up with you or?
No. I'm okay. Not sure what order you have them in. My constituent, Pete Shepherd, is here.
He is next on the agenda. If you,
Pete, come on up.
And Mr. Chair, did you want me to summarize 106?
Yes. Yes. Okay. So she's going to go ahead and summarize 106
just
before we
briefly, go ahead. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, because you opened them at the same time, Senate Bill 106 was also previously heard on this, on the, sorry, Senate Bill 481 was heard February 22nd, this is the Attorney General's bill. I may have mischaracterized the governor's bill as Senate Bill 106. The Attorney General's bill is Senate Bill 481. This measure also has an amendment that was received. I believe it's a Dash 2. It's available on OLIS. We received that yesterday, that modifies the policy statement to include purposes for exemptions, provide for automatic withdrawal of requests that are inactive for 60 days, rewords the appeals process, defines the business day, clarifies that the comprehensive list of exemptions, the catalog that they're going to prepare, may not be exhaustive. And that's the only amendment that we have on 481.
Thank you, Chair Riley. Committee members, John Huffman, State Rep for House District 59. And in House District 59 is Pete Shepherd, one of my constituents. And I want to set the table a little bit for you, if I could. I got caught about a month ago, and I know that's never happened to any other legislator. It's unique to me. I was working on public records, and there are actually going to be three bills, a three-legged stool that I hope both chambers will pass through and make into law, because together Senate Bill 106, Senate Bill 481, and House Bill 2101 in its amended form will create a three-legged stool, a system or a framework of public records management and exemption management that we've never had before. And I think it's extremely necessary. I've been a member of the Attorney General's Task Force at the behest of Aaron Knott, but we're not going to throw stones at him today. I happily served on that task force. About a month ago, I was emailing back and forth with Pete, and I made the mistake of mentioning something as a possible amendment. And being the kind person that he is, instead of emailing back and saying, John, you didn't read my 38-page memo, did you? My 38-page testimony on public records, I could tell I was caught. So that weekend, I read through the 38-page testimony. I have encouraged others to do the same because it is beneficial. And I say that to say that since that point over the last month, we have worked very hard with the Attorney General's office, the Governor's office, the Oregon newspaper publishers, the Society of Professional Journalists, Oregon Association of Broadcasters, and anybody else that says they want to have an opinion on public records. We've worked very hard to have everybody's voice here. Are all three bills perfect? Some would say yes and some would say no. But I think we've worked really hard to get to that. We're close to that sweet spot on all three bills, and I think we're very close to move forward. I have asked Pete to please limit his testimony to 3 hours. I hope that was okay, Mr. Chair, and not read the 38 pages word for word. I have another meeting, but thank you for your indulgence, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Any questions for Rep. Huffman? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Shepard, I read the 38 pages, so you don't need to read them into the record. So go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first my thanks to Representative Huffman. He's really been great to work with on this project, and I really appreciate the energy and enthusiasm and creativity that he's brought to bear. And I agree with his judgment that you all collectively in this body, both houses, are between the three bills, really are poised to make a significant improvement in what, after all, has been truly a 50-year success story in open governance in Oregon. And this is, I think, a great opportunity in this session of the Legislative Assembly to achieve that goal. And I think in the array of folks who've helped create that opportunity, Representative Huffman certainly is one, but so too are Governor Brown and Attorney General Rosenblum.
Let me interrupt you for a second. Could you put your name on the record?
Yes. I'm Pete Shepard. I'm a constituent of Representative Huffman's. I live in Sisters, Oregon.
Thank you.
I want to make sure that to the extent that I have some suggestions for improvements in Senate Bill 106, House Bill 2101, or Senate Bill 481. I support passage of all three with amendments, and I applaud the effort that the various sponsors have made to bring those issues to you. And finally, by way of reassurance to the committee, when I was working in Indian Country in my private previous professional life, I acquired a nickname of Long Wind, and so I'm going to endeavor not to live up to it in the oral testimony here. With respect to Senate Bill 106, this is the one introduced at the request of Governor Brown. It's been aptly summarized by your staff. I think the pending amendments, as your staff has described them, these are the amendments which are not yet before you but are in the works. I think those would, on balance, represent a very significant improvement in the bill as introduced. There, even with the adoption of those amendments, in my personal judgment, there'd be some further adjustments to be made to the bill. But I think that bill has a longer path to travel because it's likely to have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. And so, on balance, I've concluded I think my recommendation to you would be to adopt those pending amendments when they arrive and get the bill on its way, even though I might, if I were King, make a little bit of a further adjustment to the text of that bill. With respect to Senate Bill 481, I'll direct my remarks to the -2 amendments, which I understand are intended to be a substitute in total for the pending bill. This, of course, is the bill, as your staff has described, that's been introduced at the request of Attorney General Rosenblum. I think that the -2 amendments are a significant improvement over the printed bill. In particular, I think the addition of more specific timelines to the proposal, I've looked at those and I think they are workable. In my former professional experience, in addition to working for the Department of Justice for many years and advising state agencies, I also worked during my period in private practice as the city attorney for small cities. And so public records issues have different impacts, of course, on different parts of the government. And I tried to think about the issues in that context, too. And while I represent no one here and certainly don't speak for any cities, I do think that these proposed specific timelines are probably workable. And I think they represent an improvement over the current law. And I think they will have the effect of speeding the fulfillment of certain public records requests. So I think those are useful additions by the -2 amendments. There are other features of the -2 amendments that I think are also good. But I want to focus just briefly on two where I think further work, in my opinion, ought to be done before those amendments are adopted. The first area of improvement, I think, bears on the findings and declarations section that would be added under the bill. under the Dash 2 amendments. And there, I have two problems with this. One, I think that they follow a form of statutory enactment that isn't as useful as it ought to be. They are not all the elements of the findings and declarations section they're not all directive. They don't tell people what to do. They simply declare that something ought to be, some idea ought to be. And I think that is dangerous because those non-directive statutes will not, they will create the illusion of forward progress on a given issue that's addressed there, but they won't have the effect that the full effect that the proponents hope that they will have. And let me give you one example. And it's very timely to the question of timeliness. And that is the element of the Dash 2 amendments on page 2, line 3, that declare it that access to public records be timely. That provision in itself alone doesn't tell us to do anything or not to do anything. It simply says that we access to public records be timely in the text, in the language. So now imagine a case in which a requester is arguing that the bill, this provision of the bill, requires the agency to act faster, and the agency is saying, I'm acting in compliance with the letter of the law regarding the timeliness of response. When a court comes to construe, to deal with that dispute, the advocate of the position that says that you ought to pay attention to this non-directive part of the statute is going to have a pretty weak argument that non-directive provision of law ought to control over the specific provision upon which the local government is relying. And in the written materials, I've provided you with some other examples of how that actually plays out in real-world cases where the hopes of the person relying on the general non-directive language are defeated by the specific language of the statute. And I wouldn't recommend that you follow that course in trying to improve the public records law. I also have a problem with the findings and declarations section of the Dash 2 amendments because I think they incompletely state some of the critical public interests that are at issue in a great many public records matters. And I don't think failing to capture these public interests is prudent at this stage in an effort to improve the statute. The first public interest that I think it fails to capture adequately is I think a really critical one, and I want to take you back to the origination of the statute without going beyond page 12 of my 34 pages. And just tell you that when the statute was initially adopted in the early 1970s, it drew directly out of a concern for the linkage between access to public records and the exercise of the constitutional right to, in that case, it was discussed in the context of the First Amendment, but in an Oregon context, it would be the Oregon constitutional protection of the right to freely express oneself on any subject. And that's a right that all of us possess, not just reporters and editors. And the current law does not expressly incorporate into its text that very fundamental root of its origin. And in my experience as somebody who's litigated these cases both on both ends of the spectrum, I think that's an omission that ought to be cured. The findings and declaration section of the Dash 2 amendments does not cure that omission. I would cure that by adding an appropriate reference to that interest. The other interests that I think it fails to express are also important, and these happen to be public interests in non-disclosure. And the first of these that the findings and declarations does not capture is the public interest in non-disclosure is the public interest in disclosure for the purpose of private economic purposes. There are many requesters who currently use the public records law to get access to information that they need to facilitate a private economic transaction, such as a title company looking for evidence that, to pick an agency at random, the Department of Environmental Quality has prepared work on a particular parcel of property regarding the cleanup of that parcel. And the participants in that private economic transaction want access to the public records for the purpose of facilitating their private interests in knowing whether the property remains contaminated or not. The findings and declarations section of the Dash 2 amendments does not refer to that as a reason for underlying disclosure, and I think it ought to. So the interest in non-disclosure that I think the findings and declarations fails to capture is the interest in non-disclosure that underlines exemptions such as the internal advisory communication exemption that exists under current law. That's the exemption, that's the let-your-hair-down exemption that allows public officials in a multi-entity, multi-person decision-making process to be as frank and explicit with one another as they might be without an undue risk of having that frankness disclosed in all its glory on the pages of the newspaper in the next day. Now, there are lots of disputes about whether that's a prudent thing to have in current law. But it is in current law, and the findings and declarations process, current statement in the findings and declarations doesn't have any information about that being a reason for an exemption under current law. I think you have a good alternative to look at that I think would avoid the difficulties that I've described, and I think would have advantages for everybody involved, and that is the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2101. I hope that those will eventually be transformed into amendments to 481, and those would cure that by providing, in effect, definitions of public interest in disclosure and public interest in non-disclosure. The other major concern I have about
Senator Brzezinski.
Pete, just because we're going to continue, let me just clarify on that last part. If we take the Dash 2s that are in the House Bill 2101, I believe.
Drafted for inclusion, Senator, not included yet.
Okay, yeah. For inclusion. Is that amendment in itself all we would need to take care of the concerns you have with the current drafted Dash 2s for 481? In other words, substitute one
yes.
for the other.
I would strike the section in the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 481 that deals with findings and declarations, and substitute for that in total the Dash 2 amendments in essentially the same text as they've been prepared for 2101.
Okay.
At present, that would be my recommendation to the committee.
Thank you.
The other concern I have about the Dash 2 amendments is that I think that they don't go as far as they ought to in some respects to create incentives for public officials to share records, even though those records may be subject to an exemption. So, the core of the public records law is that it's a disclosure law, fundamentally. And one of the implications of that understanding of the law is that even if an exemption applies, that doesn't mean that the public body must keep it confidential. Rather, the right way to think about it is that the public body now has the option of keeping it confidential, keeping it within the exemption if an exemption applies. And if we want to maximize the access to public records, I think we have to think about ways to create incentives for public officials to say, even though this is within an exemption, nevertheless, I choose to disclose it. And one of the impediments to that action, in my experience, is the fear of liability from release of that. Now, Senate Bill 481-2, subsection 9, one, I think, partially addresses the issue. But it only applies, the immunity that's extended there for the release of records only applies when the public records law compels disclosure. That is to say, when an exemption does not apply. That's the circumstance under which there is a compulsion on the public official to release the record. And that should be a basis for immunity. I agree with that. But that doesn't address the much larger area of trying to create incentives for officials to release records that are exempt. And so, again, I think there's a way of doing that. I've suggested some language in the form of House Bill 2101-4, the amendments designated 2104-4, which would cure, in my view, cure that problem, enlarge the immunity to include the voluntary release of records, even where they are otherwise subject to an exemption, under conditions that are designed to make sure that that won't really damage somebody's interest who's the subject of the released records that won't cause an injury that ought to be compensated. But I think the Dash 4 amendments, by way of addition to what's in the current immunity provision, would be prudent. So I think I only got to page 32, Mr. Chair.
So any questions for Longwind? Senator Przanski.
Thank you, Pete. Thank you very much for all the time and effort you've put in. It's always been a pleasure working with you over the years, and I would hope that you will continue to monitor and work with us to make sure we do it right, because, as you said, this is really a principle for the people of this state to ensure that we do have the understanding that we are a disclosing state and that we do believe that transparency is good and better. I would like to follow up on the Senate Bill 106, where you stated that it still needs work, but you think maybe we need to go ahead and move it forward and through the process, since it's heading to Ways and Means. I would strongly encourage you to provide the committee with whatever points you think we should be covering, because my preference would be to take care of it here in the policy committee, making sure that we give them a package that we don't need to ask them to make modifications, because, as you know, once it gets down there, it could be a completely different ballgame.
Mr. Chair, Senator Przanski, the point is simple. Where I would further tweak the legislation, if it were up to me, the legislation will continue even with these pending amendments, as I understand it, to eliminate the role of a district attorney in, I think, by my calculation, 22 counties from ruling on public records petitions for an order compelling release of public records. The breaking point is 75,000. If I looked at the census data right, I think it works out to 22 counties. I just think that's such an important function that it ought to be lodged with someone who's politically accountable to an electorate.
Yeah.
And under the bill, as I understand it, will continue to be, if the pending amendments are adopted, that role will be assigned instead to the advocate. To me, I'd like to have an opportunity to vote the rascal out if there's a consistent failure to effectively rule on public records petitions. There are a couple of alternatives that I can think of that could solve that problem and still perhaps relieve, if the goal is to try and find a way to relieve district attorneys in counties that are sparsely populated, perhaps already understaffed in terms of their other responsibilities. I can think of two ways that might be done. One would be to assign that duty, instead of assigning it to the advocate, assign it to the Attorney General's office that maintains the electoral connection and also serves the purpose of ensuring that the rulings on at least the petitions in those 22 counties are done consistently with the rulings that may be occurring otherwise and operating within the Attorney General's purview to rule on similar petitions arising out of agency denials. And the other possibility, kind of a medium ground between those two, would be to create the option for a district attorney to ask his or her lawyer in the Attorney General's office to issue the public records order, perhaps even as a special deputy district attorney, which it happens occasionally. I enjoyed the privilege of being appointed a special deputy DA for a couple of counties around the state for criminal prosecution purposes, and I don't see a reason why it couldn't happen for the purpose of writing public records order from that county. But either of those options to me would be superior, just from the general standpoint that I'd rather have this important function be lodged in an official who has some direct electoral accountability.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I just want to follow up on that. I wasn't sure exactly where you're going, but based on what you're saying, this is something I had a brief conversation with Pete on. I can tell you, in my past life in the district attorney's office for Lane County, I had the task of doing this at least once, I think twice in my time there, ruling on public records. I agree with what Pete Shepherd is saying. To me, the accountability should be at the elected official at the local level. I appreciate that there may be workload issues for some of the smaller counties and their groups. But to me, this is bare democracy. This is something that I feel very strongly that we need to ensure that those decisions are made through an individual who is going to be accountable to the voters as to what they do or don't do. Of the alternatives, if we were going to look at one, the only one I would even be willing to consider would be a special assignment from an assistant district attorney to the district attorney's office, where it still comes out underneath and will still be under the banner of the district attorney.
And be accountable.
At that local level.
Yeah. So, thank you. So, I agree with Senator Brzezinski, and I hope that we can ask you to give us some notes on how you would change these amendments and have us go forward. And I really appreciate all your work on this. You've done a lot of work and talked to us for a long time, and that's great. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I'm going to call Rebecca Gladstone, and I think just Rebecca right now.
Sometimes these are too loud, sometimes too quiet.
Yeah, Becky, if you keep it away from you, you don't have to lean in. It's very, very sensitive.
Thank you. I've actually been asked to speak louder in some, just a second here. I can start with 106.
Go ahead. Whatever you want to, however you want to do it.
Thank you. Chair Riley, members of the committee, my name is Rebecca Gladstone. For the record, I'm speaking on behalf of the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I'll speak to 106 first. Let's see. The League supports this bill to create a public records advocate and counsel relating to our mission to work for a fully responsive, accessible, and transparent government. We commend the work of the Attorney General's Public Records Law Reform Task Force after passage of Senate Bill 9 in 2015, which we supported. We have an eye to our budget shortfall. Initial investment could be prioritized in the context of dramatic program savings. We acknowledge the 50th anniversary of the Federal Freedom of Information Act with 9 disclosure exemptions. Oregon has an estimated 550 disorganized public records disclosure exemptions. Organizing those exemptions to ease compliance could markedly improve service and savings. From the Oregonian, June 29, 2016, the $1 million quote from Portland Police was based on the Bureau's claim that it would need to review more than 500,000 records, individual cases, to see if there were ongoing investigations allowed to be exempt from public disclosure. Apparently, and the Oregonian said, I'm continuing, apparently a sort button doesn't exist in their data system. The council could seek similar service improvements and savings. This legislation allows the council to set rules that allows them to apply processes. Please consider, take care with council decision making. With quarterly meetings and few voices, it's important that members be included not just by quorum, but perhaps to allow voting in absentia when necessary. I would refer you to an article from the New York Times, and it's linked in my testimony. Should we see everything a cop sees? We're concerned about fiscal vulnerability. We see mediation as a way to rein in large costs by focusing records requests to needs. Defining the press to determine fee waivers may warrant discussion. Mediation should be optional, with sensitivity to imposition versus optional service for our small rural counties. We're concerned with possible confusion for mandatory interpretation with the word shall 35 times in this bill. We caution that phase-in in expectations should be realistic given the scope of this project and related expenses. We urge support of this bill, Senate Bill 106. Let me go to the other one.
some of this testimony is redundant. I'll try to churn it up. Let's see, DDD. Privacy protection and disclosure are central conflicting interests. We laud the task force's intention to favor the public's right to know in reviewing and organizing disclosure exemption categories. Legislative Council tagging and sharing new legislation for ongoing disclosure exemption cataloging is imperative. Statute should be adaptable regarding emails, text, social media, etc. Our 50-year-old Freedom of Information Act did not foresee these challenges, not only for cataloging and retaining the vast volume of records, but for a vulnerability to crippling disclosure costs exacerbated by the volume of information. We encourage review and revision of records retention time periods. We want to ensure that the time requirements defined here for acknowledging receipt of requests and so forth will be revised. And the testimony says, to reflect these new technologies, what I intended was to adapt to possible improvements in the ability to handle them, so these might be shortened. Fees charged and costs incurred have been serious concerns. When requested records are collected, attorneys review them for exemption disclosure compliance, then redact them. Process should be automated where possible. For example, tagging cases under litigation, I'm sorry, that's a repeat. Fee waivers criteria are determined through DAS and are appropriate, for example, clarifying for the public good, public versus commercial profit, and weighing overly broad requests. The League is sensitive to revenue impacts of all proposed legislation. We're concerned with fiscal vulnerability to broad requests for public records, and this is a repeat of the New York Times article. Program costs could be prioritized in the context of wise current investment for long-term savings. This legislation is characterized as taking steps, and we support ongoing public records access evaluation emphasizing transparency. Policy and practice must align. We urge support of this bill, and thank you for the opportunity to discuss this legislation.
Questions for Ms. Gladstone? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I'm going to call Carly Broussard, Gordon Friedman, and Greg Peden? Greg Peden.
Hi, I'm Carly Brousseau. I'm a reporter at The Oregonian. I work on the investigative team as a data reporter, so I often make requests for spreadsheets and databases of government agencies. And I'm also a member of SBJ's Sunshine Committee. Do you guys want
to? No.
Okay. I don't know if you saw, but there was a recent poll by DHM Research, and it shows some pretty outstanding support for transparency in Oregon. Among the findings was that 85% of Oregonians support the idea that every citizen should have complete access to information about their state government. So I wanted to start with that just because there's very wide support for these ideas. Obviously, the governor and the attorney general are looking to find ways to improve our processes, and we very much appreciate that and appreciate being part of this discussion. We're also interested in the in cost savings and efficiency through increased communication, and that's part of I think that's implicit in both bills that we're discussing today. The concerns that we have with SB 106 as it currently exists are kind of in three categories: independence, authority, and discretion to sort of maximize the kind of bang for the buck that we get out of a small office like this. Right now, the office has a variety of responsibilities, and I would certainly like to see an emphasis on facilitation and a kind of flexibility to kind of cut through the red tape. What I've found in my experience in Oregon with the public records law is that there's a lot of legal review required, and that's associated with the exemptions many times. I would like to see this office focus on the public interest and just sort of like getting to the bottom of a dispute pretty quickly. So that's in a nutshell my take on that idea of discretion. I worry with a process, a sort of more mandatory mediation process, that some of that discretion could be lost. I think the same, I share some of Mr. Shepherd's concerns about the incorporation of the power to write opinions on behalf of rural DAs. I think that takes away time from other responsibilities, and I also share some concerns about that political accountability. I came to Oregon from Arizona, and I mentioned that because Arizona has an ombudsman that I worked with quite extensively. And I actually called back to ask their take on some of these proposals because I thought it was interesting. In that case, I mean, it's also a very small office, and they really did focus on that flexibility and on facilitation. I mean, I called quite often this office, and even after I've had extensive discussions with an agency, I found that a call from the ombudsman's office, as it was called there, quite often resolved things. You know, it was a third party who's saying, you know, this is the correct interpretation. You can view it this way. This is my opinion. It's based on this case law. I believe that the correct resolution would be this. And just kind of that statement resolved it. It wasn't necessary for there to be another step. And I think that's very powerful. There were also cases where an agency would not accept a recommendation, and that office was empowered to write reports and make public statements about the public records law, and that was also very useful. So I think there's a lot to learn from that model. One concern that SBJ has voiced earlier on in other forums is that we believe it should be explicit that the person who has this position, if this bill passes, be able to review the records in question. It's very difficult, I think, to come to sort of a conclusion that all parties trust and value if the person making the decision does not have adequate information, and we think that just should be explicit. The office has been moved from, or in one of the amendments, I guess, pending amendments. I'm not sure I completely follow the amendments, but as I understood the last information that I received from the governor's office, the proposal was to move the office to the Secretary of State's office. And we still have some concerns about that question of independence. We'd like to further discuss ways in which to increase that independence. Perhaps that some of those questions relate to the council, how the council is appointed, and whether the council can appoint the advocate. I've already kind of covered some of the ground about the local DAs. We had previously discussed an idea quite similar to the one that you heard just a bit earlier from Mr. Shepherd. We think the AG performs this task, the task of reviewing public records requests and whether their records should be disclosed, quite ably, and they have the expertise, they can do it efficiently. We wonder whether there's a way for what Mr. Shepherd, to entertain those ideas. So in summary, we think the idea has a lot of promise. We really would like to see an emphasis on training, education, facilitation, discussion of the public interest, and hope that this office has the leeway and time to do that. On Senate Bill 481, we also support this legislation and hope that it moves forward. Both bills, we hope, move forward, and we would like to resolve some of these further issues in the work group context, if at all possible. We found that very valuable. Part of what is included in Senate Bill 481 is time benchmarks associated with acknowledging a request and providing the records associated with it. Right now, there's a safety valve provision that we worry the exception could kind of become the rule. So we would like to see that language tightened and to include language about an explanation provided to a requester about when there are exceptional circumstances that makes it impossible to provide records in the benchmark time. We believe that the requester should receive an explanation of those exceptional circumstances and to receive that in a timely way, perhaps at the moment of acknowledgement. That is, in summary, I think, what I have to say. We really are interested in reducing costs and increasing efficiency, and we really appreciate your interest.
Great. I think I'm surprised that only 85% of the people think we should be more transparent. Go ahead.
Chair Riley, members of the committee, my name is Gordon Friedman. I'm a reporter for the Oregonian. I'm also vice president of the Oregon Territory Chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists. I'm here speaking on behalf of the SBJ Oregon chapter. And I'd like to say that I support the testimony we just heard from my colleague. And it's the position of the SBJ that it's vitally important that what legislation does come to pass, if any comes to pass, that it enshrines timely access to public records and shows strong support for transparency. I know that's everyone's goal here, and we appreciate the work that's been done by the committee and the work group so far, particularly on some of the amendments that Mr. Shepherd has written. We already have a few of our group's members reviewing those amendments and raising the alarm. They have some concerns about what those amendments would do, and we think that the work group should have time to fully consider them and how they would work before the committee adopts them. We just want to again say that we appreciate the work of the committee and the work group, and thank you for your time.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Greg Peden. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. I want to say to start with ONPA supports both of the underlying bills you're considering here today, 106 and 481. Been part of the work group. Appreciate the work of the work group committee and all of the constituents that are here that have put in a lot of time to try to get these. I think, as you've heard from these folks here and from Mr. Shepherd, there's a lot of detail here. There's a lot of substance to these bills. I think we are very close. We want to see both of these bills pass, and we're very close to getting there. There's one piece that, not to reiterate what other folks have said, there's one piece I wanted to particularly bring to your concern that we care about, and that is in the dash 2 amendments to 481, there is the section 2 sub 3. Mr. Shepherd talked about them very articulately, so I'll just try to explain our concerns there. We're not sure what that language means. We're not sure, because it's a policy statement, whether it has the force of law or not, particularly in light of what Mr. Shepherd said as describing the language as non-directive, even further weakens our understanding of exactly what the purpose of that language is or how it would be interpreted by an elected official or an agency or a court on when that language would apply to a request or not, and we would specifically oppose that section of the amendments. Most of the bills and a lot of the issues that were raised here by Mr. Shepherd and others, we agree with. We think there is some tightening yet to come. It sounds like we're probably working through these two bills and the House bill that Representative Huffman mentioned. I think we're incorporating all those three together in what vehicle ultimately comes together. We hope to be able to support it at the final decision making, but I wanted to bring this specific point to your concern today. Thanks.
Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you. Greg, just to make certain I got what you said on the for the record.
Yes.
We're on the dash 2s to 481, section 2, starting on line 12 is sub 3, and
yes,
continuing on page 3. Concluding down on at the end of that section, which would be the page 12, or excuse me, line 12 on page 3.
Not Senator Brzezinski, not quite. I'm specifically referring to page 1.
Okay.
Section 2, sub 3.
Only.
Lines 12 through 17.
17, got
yes.
It. Yeah, I see the 4 now.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator.
Yeah, I would tend to agree, and I think Pete Shepard made a comment similar about another section, and I'm supportive of where we're going here. But it if this language doesn't have any impact, then it's just kind of commentary. And this section, which was just pointed out, feels like I just want to remind you that there are some reasons why you don't make records public. And you know it doesn't direct anything. So I just wanted to chime in there that I'm in agreement with Senator Brzezinski and Mr. Peden.
Mr. Chair, if Senator Hess is done, yeah. So was it Carl?
Gordon.
Excuse me. So Gordon, you kind of alluded to having some concerns, at least your internal work group looking at some of the amendments that are being done. Can you give us a little more specifics so we can kind of focus on what those might be, or can you at least, if you don't have it ready now, get it to us, to the committee staff, so we can actually have that in front of us as we're looking at what's coming out?
Yes, Senator Brzezinski, my understanding is that our Sunshine Committee has some concerns about the definition of public interest in disclosure, public interest in non-disclosure, but we'll get you something in writing.
That'd be great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. So I'm going to call Jeff Merrick, Simon Perotti, and Donna Silverberg.
Senator Riley and members of the committee, my name is Jeff Merrick. Thank you again for all your work on this. I've been here before. I'm here again. And you've got a lot of things on your plate. I'm just going to focus on, and it's good to see Sam here, on mediation, what it is and what it isn't, because I think part of this bill is going to lose the benefits of mediation unless it's corrected. I've been a trial lawyer since the mid-'80s. I've been a mediator for the last 5 years, and I'm now evangelical when it comes to mediation. And mediation works when it works because there's a feeling of openness between the parties. They understand they're in a safe environment. It's confidential. They can say what they want to say. They're not going to be penalized for it. So if somebody comes in and has a request for public records that says, I want any and all records having to do with the Columbia River crossing, and the agency says, well, that's going to cost you $2 million and take 6 months. And then if the person can trust you, they'll say, well, really, I'm trying to get opposition research on Senator Riley. and they can maybe focus the request and get it done faster. So as I look at all the reports, you got two issues. You got a technology issue. And that's going to take money and time, and people are already working on that with the Secretary of State's office and the governor's office. Then you have a people issue. And that's where the mediators can hopefully help you if it's done right. And you've got two subsets of the people issues. You've got people who don't understand the process or are otherwise, they're not communicating well. You can deal with that. You've got people who do act in bad faith for whatever reason. You know, they're trying to hide something. And that's that you're not going to deal with in mediation anyway, because if they're, you know, just like in civil litigation, sometimes the lawyer will say, gee, Jeff, I know you're right, but I can't give it to you without a court order. And so you just get onto it. You know, go to the court order. But for the cases where it can help, you got to trust the mediator. And you're going to lose that trust and lose the benefits if you make the mediator somebody who's describing bad faith, who's telling people that if you don't do it my way, it's going to be a ruling of bad faith. So if you're making the mediator do the DA's work in those 22 counties, you're doing yourself a disservice. If you make the mediator serve as a person who's arbitrating good or bad faith, you're wasting the mediator. On the other hand, if you have the mediator help you with help the parties with, what do you really need? What do you really want? How do we get it to you? You're going to grease the wheels of the process. If you don't let the mediator do his or her job, you're going to throw a monkey wrench in the process. And the other point I want to make is make it more informal. The best judges are the ones, when you have a discovery dispute, they say, If you have a discovery dispute, pick up the phone. Don't write me a 30-page motion. Let's get it done. And same thing here. Don't necessarily wait for denial. Don't wait 21 days. Don't gum up the works with mediation. Make mediation the grease by making it as informal as possible. And that initial response, have the government say, we think it's a complex request. Here's why. And you want to talk about it, or do you want to talk through a mediator about it? Get it done right away before everybody starts getting in their silos and starting to shoot, you know, lawyer bombs at each other. That's my number one point. My number two point is, I'm not sure why you really need this advisory council. You had the AG's task force. You had the Secretary of State's audit. We know the issues. Are you going to have more responsibility when you divide it among a committee of people? Or do you just need to make a choice, governor or secretary of state, and go with it, let that person take the heat and be responsible? Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Riley, Senator Haas. My name is Sam Imperati. I'm an attorney by training, but not inclination. I am a full-time mediator and have been mediating since 1992. In my community, they call me Calm Warm Wind. Unlike Pete Shepard. Pete knows more about public records law than I can imagine. He's forgotten more than I ever hoped to know. And that's why my memo to you is one-tenth its length. In a nutshell, I'm here today to talk about process concerns, not the substantive concerns with public records and transparency. As Jeff, my colleague, indicated, mediation is a process in which a mediator assists and facilitates two or more people in resolving a controversy. That is a statutory definition under ORS Chapter 36.110. Using the word mediation in this statute and then doing things in mediation that is normally done by an arbitrator will cause great confusion amongst the users of mediation. We have an entire statutory scheme describing mediation. It is inconsistent with the role of the public advocate in this particular process. We also have a robust field. By giving the public records advocate the ability to make findings and a lack of bad faith, which can result in attorney's fees, and under the existing rule, denial of the documents, is what an arbitrator does and not a mediator. The additional problem from a mediation process perspective is that mediators, by definition, are impartial. The mere choice of the word advocate could imply to the requesting party in public that the advocate represents them or is on the side of the requester. It's amazing to me as a mediator how many times people expect me to make a decision when I make it very clear that, no, my role is that of help you make a resolution, not force you into a decision. I also believe that can't use the word mediator in this context because a mediator is a third party under the statute. And a party, which the public advocate is from my perspective, is someone who participates in the process and has a direct interest in the controversy. As written, this statute puts upon the public records advocate an educational function and an adjudicative function that's inappropriate in the mediation setting because they do have a direct interest in that process. The other aspect from a standards of practice and mediator as a profession, the Oregon Mediation Association has a document called Standards of Practice. It includes impartial regard, where the mediator must avoid actual, potential, or perceived conflicts and have no stake in the outcome. So again, it's the choice of the word mediation. It's not the substance of how you approach to do this. It's simply the choice of the words. So what are some solutions, potential solutions? Do not have the advocate be the mediator because they are a party. There are several other third-party options that can perform this important function. You have the Oregon Consensus Program, which is our state's a statewide mediation program. There are community mediators. There are private mediators. If there's no economic alternative, call the process something else: conciliation, facilitation, dispute resolution, an ombuds program, as the reporter from the Oregonian stated previously. I've attached some American Bar Association literature on the roles of an ombudsperson or ombudsman, as they still colloquially say. Please do not have the mediator, regardless of their title, be given the ability to make findings or issue advisory opinions. Again, that's what arbitrators do or other adjudicative processes. However, I suspect that part of the underlying interest in having this legislation was, if you will, a carrot and stick. So with the award of attorney's fees and costs upon prevailing, that will encourage people to be more reasonable during the negotiation process. You can accomplish that same thing without a finding by anyone. In contract law prevalent in Oregon, in real estate disputes by the Portland metropolitan area of realtors, and the offer of judgment concepts in our Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, specifically ORCP 54E, you can have the parties mediate to impasse. If there's not a settlement, they go to the next process contemplated in the court. If they win there, they automatically get their attorney's fees if they win. You don't need the good faith, bad faith finding. And if you had it, who's going to testify as to whether or not it was good faith or bad faith? The mediator cannot testify unless both parties agree, and they're unlikely to. And then even then, the mediator has an independent right not to testify, and most of us are not. Finally, with regard to impartial regard, the American Bar Association opines on the role of an ombudsman, and it says the efficacy of an office is largely dependent upon a widely held view that the ombudsman is a person of integrity who works with nonpartisan fairness and ethical behavior. So please consider that when making your appointment decision. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Senator Riley, Senator Haas. Thank you for having us here today. My name is Donna Silverberg. I, too, am a mediator, and I am the co-president of the Oregon Mediation Association. I don't have any testimony prepared for you today. I'm here to support Warmwind here and what he's just said. I was very heartened to hear the testimony of everybody. I count myself in the 85% of the people that were referred to for supporting transparency, and am very pleased to know that Pete Shepard's been working on this and is going to help us all get to the right place. I think given what Sam was just saying and given what I've heard so far, I've heard the words mediator, facilitator, advocate, arbitrator, ombudsman so far in the context of both of these bills of 106 and some conversation in 481. The Oregon Mediation Association is pleased that you preferred that choice or that the authors preferred that choice, and we are very eager to help with figuring out what the role is that people really are seeking here, and if it's a facilitator, if it's an advocate, whichever it is, that we use the right term on that so that we don't confuse the public and the person whose role it is to serve this important function for the government, that doesn't get missed in as we move forward. So the Oregon Mediation Association is eager to help however we can, and thank you very much for hearing all of us today.
Thank you very much. And it is very easy to be confused about what the role of this person is going to be.
Yes.
Can I have one final point, please?
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's not the word. It's how do you empower this person to function well and get the job done of greasing the wheels?
Right.
And it's, whether you call it a table, it doesn't matter. It's, if the person is non-biased, it's confidential, and they can help the people get to what they really care about, that's the key no matter what the name is.
Thank you. Question? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, just the Attorney General's office. So, AG's office, you want to?
Chair Riley, Senator Haas, for the record, Michael Crone from the Oregon Attorney General's office. My only wind-related nickname was bequeathed on me by my wife, and I won't repeat it in this chamber. I am here to mainly to walk you guys through what the Dash 2 amendments actually do. Along the way, I may comment a little bit on a couple of particular sections that have come up in prior testimony. So even though they're 11 pages long, they're actually really just a handful of substantive changes that are actually made in the amendments that you're looking at. A lot of it is replacing words like shall with may and just kind of small things that I'm not really going to touch on. The first one that is, I would say, an important amendment is the section that Mr. Peden referred to that he identified that he has some concerns with. This is in the policy statement. It's adding some explanation of when exemptions generally have been adopted by the Legislative Assembly. And I want to back up a little bit and just talk about the policy statement in general. As you guys all know, I think by this point, the Attorney General and I have been chairing a work group, a task force on the Oregon public records law for, I guess, about a year and a half now. It has been an interesting experience, is how I've heard one of the members describe it a couple of times. I think everyone knows that there's a history in Oregon of failed attempts to reform the public records law. And we tried to address that by getting really the key stakeholders to sit down and work together and come to some difficult, potentially, compromises and also common ground. And actually, the idea of a policy statement, everyone on the task force understands that the policy statement is not operative law. The idea actually came from Les Zeitz, who I think spoke to this committee a few weeks ago now, who was at that time representing the Society of Professional Journalists on the task force. And it's really an idea that's designed to do three things. One is it's, and this I'm going to list them, I think, in the order of their importance. The first one is that it's intended to let both requesters and public bodies who have public records have something they can just look at that in a nutshell distills for them the purpose of the law so that they can evaluate, especially on the side of the public body, whether their response to the request is really in keeping with the spirit of the law. So something that just very clearly articulates what the purpose of the law is. The second thing is we wanted to give some guidance, frankly, to the legislature going forward. Again, we realize this is not binding guidance, but our review of the law indicates that in 40-some years, the legislature has adopted 500 exemptions and that they're not necessarily all consistent. And we thought that having a sort of statutory statement of policy that legislators at least might be referred to could help future legislators to think sort of in a structured way about where does this exemption fit in the overall structure of the Oregon public records law, this exemption we're considering, and is it really doing something that needs to be done? And then the third is that we do think there's some utility to courts, but that's not certainly not going to be the most important thing. The Oregon public meetings law has a similar statement, and the courts do use it a lot. So the you need to hurry me up, huh?
No. I don't mean to interrupt. I just so what you're saying is these are kind of the equivalent of whereas's clause that you typically see at the beginning of a bill. And I don't have any quarrel with that. It just struck me that this would be, you know, some of these phrases were down a little bit deeper than at the very beginning, and it didn't have that kind of typical whereas thing. Like the one phrase that got me was, you know, public records are sometimes appropriate, you know, disclosure. You know, phrases like that did strike me as kind of clunky or, you know, just unnecessary.
Yeah, and I think this section in particular, I already mentioned that ONPA has expressed some concerns about. The Attorney General's office, is definitely committed to continuing to work with the stakeholder group that I'm talking about. I really think that we are down to basically, in my view, we have basically two small disputes where we're not even really disagreeing on policy, I don't think so much, but trying to get the language, I think, tightened is the way Ms. Brousseau put it, in two areas where
it to newspaper reporters to try and get you to tighten up the language.
No, I think it's important. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, sorry,
Senator,
I didn't mean to interrupt, but just wondered since you were on that topic. No,
it's an appreciated point. And I think that what's in here now is actually something that was in the task force version of the policy statement at one point, came out. is now coming back in, and the desire for putting something like it back in is, again, just to sort of help people understand why sometimes they may not get records, and also to help the legislature think about, you know, as we're creating new exemptions or considering them, does this really fit in with our state policy? So I don't really want to spend more time on that unless you have further questions. I'll move to the next change that I think is significant. We added a definition of what a business day is. Most of the time frames in the bill are all of them actually use this idea of business day. And this is primarily actually something that we worked out with the school districts. The school districts expressed a concern about some of their smaller schools where, you know, Monday to Friday might be typically considered a business day, but in a small district during the summer, if it's a district that only has one administrator, there may literally not be anyone in the office. So we tried to come up with a definition that would work in terms of not, you know, not giving the Portland Public Schools the entire summer off, but would actually recognize the needs where they arise. And I am happy to, please don't feel like you're interrupting me. I'm happy to take questions as I go through this. I'm also going to try to make it quick because I don't think I'm your last witness. Next, we did a little bit of work on the tightening of the safety valve language. This is the area where SPJ suggested they'd like to see a few additional tweaks. That really, those two places I think really are where we have a little bit of tweaking to do. And my honest view is that we are in agreement on policy and have not quite got the language that makes everyone happy. So the language here is actually, I think, fairly similar to the language you initially saw. I want to talk in particular about one word. One of the reasons why we excuse people from complying with the time frames is if the staff or the volunteers who are necessary to complete a response to the public records requests are unavailable. That word necessary was one we talked about a little bit. We considered whether we should talk about the people who are assigned to the request. Ultimately, we went necessary for two reasons. One is because sometimes the people who are assigned to the request are necessary, right? So if they're not there, then if they're necessary and they're not there, then you're going to get out anyway. But in a big agency, frankly, like the Department of Justice, we have people who are assigned to the requests, but if they're missing, then someone else ought to be stepping in to fill the slack. So we chose necessary for that reason, but also for the reason that there could be someone other than the person whose job it is to handle these things that is necessary. So if to go back to schools, for example, if a record is literally in the hands of a teacher, but that teacher is unavailable for a week because they're sick or whatever, we wanted to make it clear that then anybody who's necessary being absent is a legitimate reason. And again, I don't think that's really the area where the SPJ has concerns. They're interested in talking about getting an explanation of those reasons later on, which is something we're absolutely willing to talk to them about. And looking forward to continuing those conversations. I think I have three more changes that I want to highlight. Okay, quickly, the next is we just made it crystal clear that if you are excused from the strict time frames, you still have to do your work as soon as you reasonably can. Everyone agreed on that. I think it's completely obvious. And then the next is we changed the appeals process for if you feel like someone is dragging their feet or they've given you an estimated time frame that is unreasonable. The existing language in the bill we thought was a little bit complicated and not as clear as we wanted it to be, so this really just clarifies that. And the final piece is similarly a clarifying piece that relates to the catalog that this bill would require the Attorney General to create of public records exemptions. It simply clarifies that if we miss something, that doesn't prevent a public body from asserting it. You know, that'll give us the opportunity to then get it into our catalog, but we wanted to make that clear. So those are the changes you see in the amendments. I want to thank you guys for hearing from us, senators, for hearing from us. It's been a very, I think, robust negotiating process, and we're very happy with where we are.
Thank you. Just so everybody knows, we're not through with these.
I understand.
But we need to keep in mind that we do have a deadline. We have to get bills moved by a certain date, and we need to make sure that that happens. So we need to have you get things wrapped up and get agreements and get us something that we can move. So with that, I'm going to close public hearings. We are not going to be able to do the work session on 254, so we need to carry that over. So we will carry that over to the next meeting. And with that, I think we're all done. Thank you all very much. Thank you all very much.